From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
The Illinois Accountability Commission had another hearing this week and heard testimony about immigration enforcement in Chicago. What is the goal of that commission? What was heard? We'll talk more about it. And also, what about the Chicago Bears? We still call them that, no matter where they might play. There has been some more movement on their efforts to get a new stadium. That and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, and Charlie's also been a longtime reporter and observer. Our guest is Maggie Doherty, who is a reporter with Capital News Illinois. Maggie, good to have you back with us again.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Sean.
The Illinois Accountability Commission, I mentioned that, I guess to start off with, because not everybody's following the news as closely, possibly, what is this commission? What was it set up to do, and what has it done so far?
Yeah, this commission, it was created through executive order by Governor Pritzker back in October, and it was given the sort of mandate to look into and document potential abuses by federal immigration agents while they were, you know, conducting Operation Midway Blitz in the Chicagoland area. And so that has meant looking at social media videos people have posted, collecting testimony from people impacted. And that was with the goal of both, I think, creating a public record of what had occurred and forming policy recommendations for the governor going forward. And so they are tasked with submitting a final report to the governor and the public by the end of April. They already submitted their initial report at the end of January. And the goal is to, like I said, both outline what we've seen from Operation Midway Blitz, what we've seen from these federal immigration actions in the area, see what lessons can be learned from that. You know, for example, for places like Minneapolis, where we've seen some of the same patterns repeated, and then also to create some recommendations for potential policies to prevent similar actions or abuses of power from happening in the future, as well as potentially recommending prosecutions. For example, in the shootings of Miramar Martinez and Silverio Villegas Gonzalez in Chicago, you know, if the officers here are found to have used excessive force in those shootings and the federal government isn't going to hold them accountable, are there ways for Chicago law enforcement to do that, you know, in the lieu of federal actions on those, you know, two shootings?
So this week, there were a lot of academics, I believe, some others who work with youth who were there as well to talk about maybe what the impact has been on younger people. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. They had a big panel this week. It was 12 experts in this long 4-hour meeting. It was also the biggest crowd that I've seen there in their three, or I think this was the third public meeting. This was one of the bigger ones that I've seen so far. And they had three doctors, especially two pediatricians and one, I believe, clinical child psychologist, as well as educators, community organizers, advocates, to talk about four key sort of areas of life that have been impacted by Operation Midway Blitz, those being health, mental health, education and youth stability, public safety and community trust, and economic vitality and household stability. And so a lot of it focused on the impact on children. Like you said, there was a lot of testimony from these doctors about what they've seen both from their own patients and, you know, heard from other physicians who care for youth in the Chicagoland area. And so a lot of that was focused around the impact of family separations. So if a child, for example, is in the middle of cancer treatment, and their parent gets detained, or even if their parent doesn't get detained, but there's this sort of chilling effect because they know that there's ICE around hospitals or medical institutions, and they have to avoid appointments because they fear detention, and they send the kids to these appointments by themselves, or if they are detained or deported, then suddenly there's nobody to go pick up prescriptions for the kid. There's no insurance that just goes away. Kids' treatment in a lot of cases has just gone completely on hold. And, that can have really serious health consequences, if not be fatal. And it also has really major psychological consequences. I think people are familiar with the concept of, especially for newborns and infants, the impact of having parental connection physically. And that has been shown through research not only to have positive psychological impacts, but to have your parent, the parent holding the child also helps speed medical recovery. When parents aren't in the hospital settings, kids can develop feelings of maybe my parents don't love me. That's why my caretaker is suddenly not here with me in this scary clinical hospital setting. And so the health experts talked a lot about those things. So when their parents feel afraid to go to the grocery store, and these kids are suddenly shopping for their parents and carrying adult responsibilities that they're not really supposed to be carrying at that age, it has some, it creates a lot of stress for kids. So they talked about the psychological impacts stemming from the fear of ICE, fear of parents being deported, talking about a kid at school who felt like he couldn't buy his lunch because he couldn't punch in his lunch code. Because in his little, second, third grader mind, punching in the lunch code connects to like this big system and might tell ICE where he is. And, then ICE can come target his parents when they come to pick him up at school. It's like kids are watching. They are absorbing all of this that's around them, and it does have a real impact on their mental health when they're seeing what's going on with these immigration raids. And it was part of this kind of bigger, I guess, point of this commission meeting, which was that these raids in the Chicagoland area, they were not like a targeted strike. They were not necessarily going after the worst of the worst. They weren't just going for people who had serious, dangerous criminal records and had been arrested multiple times, and were a threat to public safety. They're just doing these kind of fishing expeditions. And when you are doing fishing expeditions, I mean, first of all, you pick up people who are citizens, you pick up people who have not created any crimes, who are productive members of society, and just going to work and living their lives. And you pick up their children, or you create these ripple down effects for their children, for the economy, for public health and safety, when people don't feel safe calling 911 to report other crimes because they're afraid of being deported. So it was a long meeting. There was a lot covered. If people are interested, there is a recording of it that you can find on YouTube from their website. It was a there's a lot of information there because it was something that had impacts on really all aspects of life for immigrants and people of color, people with accents who are afraid of being swept up in this in the area.
Well, Charlie, I guess showing my cynicism on government at times, when I first heard about this, I had to think to myself that maybe this is just something to show, hey, we're going to push back a little bit on ICE, but not really do much. But as I've heard more of it, it really seems to be more than just what I was thinking initially. It is more of a documentation of the incidents that have occurred and the impact it's having on these communities.
Yeah, and I think that that is exactly what the intent is. Now, the commission itself doesn't have any authority to, I guess, to arrest or bring charges against any of these federal agents for the purported crimes that they've been committing. But on the other hand, they're preparing documentary evidence that can be used, that can be referred to prosecutors. And there is, I don't know what the status is, but I know there has been talk, and Maggie, you can correct me if I'm wrong, about referring to state authorities some of these actions by ICE and other agents that are violating Illinois law. And so this would be And I think that the commission itself has said that we're basically gathering all of the information. They issued their first report. It was a preliminary report. It was a 72-page report that got released this week. And I didn't read the whole thing, I'll confess that. But it was interesting what the executive summary pointed out, that for example, and this is a quote from the report, DHS's actions were ostensibly predicated on the need to arrest dangerous, violent criminals, but DHS did not tell the American people that in the first 6 weeks of Operation Midway Blitz, less than 15% of the individuals arrested had any criminal record. Only 3% had a violent crime in their record. Many of the people arrested were U.S. citizens targeted based on their race or language. That the people they attacked with tear gas included peaceful protesters exercising their rights, children, and bystanders. And they pointed out misdirection and lies were not only a pattern, but a feature of Operation Midway Blitz. And so the commission, I believe, is going to hear from other individuals, and it also has a website, and it's solicited folks who have personal experience to send in what happened to them. And they're going to come up with a report that's, I'm pretty sure they will recommend that state charges be leveled against some of these federal agents, and that state law, to the extent that it can affect federal activities, should be amended to do things like forbid the use of masks, no identification, so that the federal agents would be on a similar plane as state and local police, because you know you're out in your neighborhood, and like in my case, my big offense is that I tend to speed, so I stop and get a speeding ticket. The officer who stops me, he's got a badge, he's got a name, he doesn't wear a face mask, and so that strikes me as the kind of thing that has to be addressed.
Well, Maggie, like Charlie mentioned, a preliminary report's been issued. I guess the final report is due in April. The timing on that, like Charlie was mentioning, I guess, is being done in a sense, too, not just for possible charges, but maybe for legislation that could be introduced and passed in May, end of May.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of things that they had put out in that first report in terms of sort of previewing the recommendations they might make. One is about use of force and the use of chemical weapons, less lethal weapons they're classified as. Although, of course, if they're misused, they can be lethal. Those are things like tear gas and pepper spray. In the first commission public hearing, they heard from an expert in chemical weapons who talked a lot about those, less lethal chemical irritants. And I think that I'm not totally sure. I honestly have not looked at the bill myself, but I did hear talk that there was possibly a bill that has been introduced or would be introduced limiting or prohibiting fully the use of chemical irritants in Illinois. These are weapons of war, but they are allowed for use against domestic protesters for crowd control. And I believe that if Illinois was to ban that, and I could be wrong, so take this with a grain of salt, but I think that Illinois, if it were to pass something like this, would be the first state to ban use of chemical weapons. And so that would have really major implications. I mean, that was a really big part of what we saw with Operation Midway Blitz, was this use of chemical irritants against protesters for ostensibly crowd control, and it causes injuries. That we saw pepper balls being shot at people's heads in ways that are against use of force regulations. So that would be a big one. I think another would be the swapping of license plates, those other kinds of identity shielding techniques, possibly regarding use of surveillance technology, like facial recognition, license plate readers, access to data about people who are protesting, and then, additional mechanisms for accountability of misconduct, and potentially transparency for those federal immigration activities. So those are some of the things they put out as I guess, previews for potential policy recommendations in the first report, I would expect that they might add some things based on what they've seen in this most recent hearing. So that would be regarding potentially children or activities around schools. You know, there was a use of chemical irritants around, I think the first use of chemical irritants in the city was around an elementary school while the kids were outside at recess. And one of the things that somebody said during that meeting, one of the, I think it was the principal who spoke or one of the other education advocates said that was the most dangerous day of school that our school has ever had for students. And it was dangerous because of the immigration enforcement agents there who are ostensibly there to, you know, provide safety, law and order, but it creates this risk. And so I would expect they might add some of those safeguards relating to health, maybe relating to law or immigration enforcement activities around hospitals and medical institutions. And then they did preview also that they expect Miramar Martinez, the woman who was shot 5 times by a Border Patrol agent back in October, to testify at the next hearing. And so that will be next month. She was at the State of the Union at invitation of a DC lawmaker during this meeting. So she wasn't able to attend. But if she's, you know, providing her testimony at the next meeting, I would expect potentially there's going to be some recommendations regarding the officer who shot her. And there's been a lot of, you know, other reporting about him.
Well, Maggie, in your story from the meeting that occurred last month, you quoted a gentleman named Garrett Graff, who's an author, a journalist. And I thought his quote was interesting. He said, "In any other foreign country, if a U.S. reporter was writing about these raids and the occupation of Chicago or Minneapolis, we wouldn't hesitate to call ICE or CBP a paramilitary force loyal to the regime or masked right-wing militia. An even larger cohort of less qualified and less trained ICE and CBP officers begins to hit the streets. This is almost all certainly going to get worse." And I think that's kind of what we're looking at ahead. So, and as the report said from the commission, their initial report is supposed to be a preliminary account, an attempt to explain how did we get here? And then the final report, I'm pretty sure, will say recommendations for how do we move off of where we are.
Let me move on to another topic a lot of people are paying a lot of attention to, not just here in Illinois, but elsewhere, and that involves the Chicago Bears. They are still pushing to get a new stadium. Arlington Heights appears to be the preferred site in Illinois, but Indiana now in the mix. Indiana passing legislation this week to basically create a stadium for them with a lot of tax incentives, a lot of taxes to pay for it. So Indiana's still trying to lure the Bears into Hammond, a site just over the state's border. Charlie, what are your thoughts? Looks like Illinois lawmakers are starting to warm up to the idea that there is competition for this team.
What the advancement in Illinois was, a House committee approved legislation. It was a vote of 13-7. The Republican on the committee all voted no, that would allow the Bears to negotiate a special payment to local taxing bodies in lieu of property taxes. And that's basically to kind of encourage the Bears to move to Arlington Heights. In Indiana, meanwhile, as you said, the governor signed legislation that creates, as one critic said, a cornucopia of new local taxes to pay for the stadium in Hammond. The stadium would not belong to the Bears. It would belong to a new authority being set up in Indiana, but the Bears would be able to play there basically rent-free. They'd get to keep all the profit off the auxiliary services, food and stuff like that. And then they could buy the stadium after, I think, 35 years for a dollar. And that sounds attractive, but as Cam Buckner, he's a Democrat from Chicago and whose district includes Soldier Field, after this hearing where the Revenue and Finance Committee voted out this package, he said that he didn't think Illinois lawmakers are in competition with Indiana. And the quote that I thought was interesting, he said, "I think that there's still people in that state that either don't know or are unsure about the smorgasbord of tax increases that's attached to their proposal." He's been like the leader of this effort to do something for the Bears in the House. And he's also adamant that there's some has to be something in there for Chicago. One of the proposals is refurbishing Soldier Field and making it a venue for other events. But my sense is, in my gut, I believe that ultimately the Bears will wind up in Arlington Heights. They will have a deal that kind of freezes their property taxes on the stadium itself, but the Bear Village, if you want to call it, the development that's going to be around the stadium, the businesses, the entertainment venues, and all the rest of that, I believe will be taxed as just any other piece of property.
And let me move on, just a couple of minutes left here. And Maggie, I wanted to ask you about a story you wrote regarding something that occurred last week. The governor issued an executive order, and it didn't get a ton of attention at the time because of his state of the state address and budget address. That's what people were paying attention to. But he issued an executive order regarding nuclear power. What does this do?
This does a couple things. Part of it is sort of a, I would say, an attempt to jumpstart or streamline site identification for potential new, places where we could hold nuclear power plants. And so that involves both issuing what's called a notice of inquiry to potential developers. That includes also existing owners of nuclear facilities who might want to expand, and also issuing notices of inquiry to communities around the state who might be interested in hosting one of these facilities. And so they're supposed to outline things like the environmental concerns, the costs, the community stakeholder support, things that would make, I guess, an attractive place for a nuclear site. This is all with the goal of getting construction started on some new nuclear facilities by 2033. Governor's goal is to bring on board 2 gigawatts of capacity, which he would said would power up to 2 million homes in Illinois. The other part of this is to form a working group, which will review the existing statutes and regulatory things that govern nuclear power and see if those things still make sense, if there's things missing, and then issue recommendations. That's, supposed to help stave off this energy shortage that has been predicted to hit Northern Illinois by 2029 and downstate by 2031. If construction's not starting till 2033, that timeline doesn't quite maybe meet the urgency of those needs. But it's this shift that he's trying to, I think, invest more in the nuclear, because it seems like that's one of the only ways to potentially meet the state's carbon-free goals of, getting off of fossil fuel plants by 2045, as required under the sort of landmark energy environment legislation passed in 2021, the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act. Folks who are really concerned about the environment say that this is too expensive and too long-term of a solution, whereas renewable sources like wind and solar can be put in place much more quickly and with less expense. The state had had prior a, 4-decade moratorium on building new nuclear energy sites. It is a shift, but it's in some ways not a shift also, because Illinois still already relies extensively on nuclear. I mean, despite the moratorium, nuclear power has accounted for about half of the state's energy production for years, because we still have these 6 sites that were grandfathered in before the moratorium went into place. So
it kind of, in a sense, it's a attempt to move away from fossil fuels. And as Maggie said, we've got a long history. And in fact, we're the top producer of nuclear energy. And I think, Maggie, in your story, we said that our reactors generate 1/8 of the nation's nuclear power. it will help get us away from fossil fuels, but there's still a question of what do you do with spent nuclear fuel? Because the nuclear fuel in a reactor is good for producing energy for only a relatively short period of time, and it's still really radioactive, dangerously radioactive, after it's no longer, I guess, strong enough to be used in generating electricity. And it has a shelf life, or what do they call it, half-life, in the tens of thousands of years. And that's a question that I don't think we've been able to resolve. How do we safely store this stuff?
It's time now for our notes from the field. And Charlie, we'll stick with you this week and go first.
Well, this past week, the legislature approved appointing a new leader for the state agency that does audits of other departments and basically all of state government. Christopher Meister, who is now the executive director of the Illinois Finance Authority, will take over on May 1st as auditor general to succeed Frank Maltino, who is going to retire then. And Maltino, a former Democratic state rep from Spring Valley, has served for the last 10 years. Interesting note, Meister will be only the fourth auditor general in Illinois' history. That's because the office was created in the 1971 Constitution. The first auditor general, Robert Cronson, served from 1974 to 1992. The second, Bill Holland, was there from 92 to 2015. And Frank Maltino took office in 2016, and he's going to retire now in 2026. In my judgment, that's one of the best run state enterprises. The audits are always super on point. They're never partisan. They're never one side or the other. They're just factual, straightforward explanations of here's what this agency did or didn't do, and here's what the law says it should do.
All right. And Maggie.
Yeah, I just wanted to preview a little bit. Today, there's a ruling expected from U.S. District Judge Jeffrey Cummings in Chicago at 1 p.m. Maybe it'll be out by the time this episode is out, regarding whether the Department of Homeland Security will need to release about 80 more people who were arrested without warrants last fall during Operation Midway Blitz. And that's been a case that's been ongoing and had some serious implications regarding ICE's tactics. And the consent decree that's here in Chicago prevents ICE from picking up people without warrants just based on a perception that they might not be able to track them down later. It's an interesting case, and it'll determine today whether dozens of people are released from custody. So that's one to watch.
All right, we'll watch that. And that is all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Maggie Doherty with Capital News Illinois. Look for State Week where you get your podcast, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.